Morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A20-1161, Free Minnesota Small Business Coalition et al. Versus Tim Walls. This case is being heard on the Zoom platform today in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The same procedural rules apply to this Zoom oral argument as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you can see, the marshal is keeping time in one of the grids on the grid view. If there's any technical difficulties, the marshal will stop the clock, and we won't restart it until the difficulties are resolved, so you get your full allotment of time. This oral argument is being recorded. No other recordings are allowed except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. I'll ask that counsel please introduce themselves and the party they represent at the start of their argument. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall and I represent the appellants, Free Minnesota, a Small Business Coalition, and the individuals and the businesses. This case is about unconstitutional delegations. There are basically two claims left. The first one is the non-delegation doctrine claim. That is, the Emergency Management Act is constitutionally unauthorized delegation of legislative emergency powers for pandemics and quarantines. In this legal claim, the constitutionality is a matter of the specificity required for a constitutional delegation. The second claim is a legislative veto claim. There, section 12.31 subdivision B2 is constitutionally unauthorized delegation to the state legislature by majority vote to end emergency powers beyond the 30 days. So on this legal claim, the law is very specific. In fact, it's quite specific, but is it constitutional and is it severable? So let's address those questions first. So I've got a copy of subdivision B here, 2B here, and I'll just read the sentence. By majority vote of each house of the legislature may terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. So one way to the best way to read that is the legislature, by majority vote of each house of the legislature, may terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. So then we would want to juxtapose that to the Constitution. And I have a copy of that here too. And that's Article 4. And I think the best section would be Section 24. And I'm going to leave out the references to order and resolution, but I'll just read the sentence. Each vote requiring the concurrence of the two houses, except as such as relate to the business or adjournment of the legislature, shall be presented to the governor and is subject to his veto as prescribed in case of a bill. So then you take 12.31 and you compare it to Article 4, Section 24, and you see that the legislature is delegated to itself the power to terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days by a majority vote of each house of the legislature. And so that Section 24 is parallel to Section 23, but it's very specific to vote. So the governor's argument, the government's argument at brief at page 33 is, I think, critical to understand. The argument partially there is, even if the legislature voted to end the peacetime powers, the matter would have to be presented to the governor to have legal effect. So it's critical to understand, the governor saying, even if the legislature votes to end at page 33, that we'd still have to see what legal effect that would have. So now the appellant's claim is very straightforward in the sense that the Emergency Management Act, because of this provision, it's unconstitutional. So that means we're arguing that's not severable. And so let's move to severability.
Mr. Cardle, before you do that, it's my understanding that the legislature hasn't voted to terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So is this claim even ripe?
Bingo. And so my argument there, Judge, would be with respect to the ripeness and the standing relates to the severability, because if it's not severable, then my client's claim that the emergency powers that are being exercised are under an unconstitutional statute, and my client is restricted. And no one denies that the governor's executors are restricting my clients now. And so with respect to the severability, we have some documents and statutes to follow. So with respect to severability, the statute is 645.20. And I'm going to just leave out a big part because I think it captures the essence, but I am reading from the statute. If any provision of a law is found to be unconstitutional and void, the remaining provisions of the law shall remain valid unless the court finds the remaining valid provisions standing alone are incomplete or incapable of being executed in accordance with the legislative intent. So the cases we cite in the brief, but generally the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that if the legislature would not have enacted the remaining provisions without those that are to be severed, the court may not sever the unconstitutional provision from the statute and leave the remaining language intact. So then we can look to Judge Gilligan's opinion at page addendum 29. Judge Gilligan described these provisions as critical part of the legislation. So I'll read. Moreover, the legislature has placed strict temporal limitations on the duration of a peacetime emergency declaration, which further supports this conclusion. The peacetime emergency cannot extend past the 5 days without the approval of the Executive Council, Minnesota Stat 12.31 Subdivision 2A. Thereafter, the peacetime emergency can only extend for 30 days and then is subject to review by the legislature, which has an opportunity to exercise its authority to end the peacetime emergency or to enact legislation that could otherwise restrict the governor's actions during a peacetime emergency. If the legislature is not in session at the expiration of the 30-day period, MEMA requires the governor to call the legislature back into session to give it an opportunity to terminate the peacetime emergency. Every 30 days since the governor declared the peacetime emergency, the legislature has had the opportunity to monitor and terminate it. Then further down, the legislature made specific choices about triggering events, temporal limitations, and additional review and oversight from the Executive Council and legislature, which provide a check on the governor's power in times of emergency. Further, Judge Gilligan, at page 33 in the discussion whether the legislature wanted the Administrative Procedures Act to apply, this is addendum 33, the court has also determined the legislature create a review process for oversight and termination of peacetime emergencies under Minnesota Stat 12.3 Subdivision 2B. So Judge Gilligan's analysis was that these temporal limitations were absolutely critical to this statute. I mean, you couldn't imagine the statute without them. And of course, the legislature would have never enacted such a statute without these temporal limitations. That's why it's not severable. So then to answer your question more specifically, so the point is it's not severable, so it's unconstitutional. And so the governor's restrictions on the businesses, which are severely restricting them and the individuals, is an unconstitutional exercise of power. And so I understand the government's argument is, well, you got to look at this before you apply the non-severability analysis. But our claim is that the Emergency Management Act is damaging us, my clients, and that the reason it's unconstitutional is because of this provision, which can't be severed. And similarly,
so, Mr. Cardall, on a related note, I think, you know, that the sort of threshold question that the court has to answer here is whether this is a justiciable argument. So Judge Cochran asked about, you know, whether it was ripe, given that the legislature has not, at least yet, exercised the veto power that you're alleging is unconstitutional. But I'm wondering if you could address another concern related to justiciability, and that is the standing issue. Does this group in this litigation have standing to attack the legislative veto problem?
Yes, and so I guess I have to repeat myself in a sense. I must not have done a good job communicating. So the legal argument is that the Emergency Management Act has an unconstitutional provision, the legislative veto, which renders the whole statute unconstitutional. The governor's actions under the Emergency Management Act directly affect my clients, the businesses and the individuals. There are restrictions on them. So that addresses the standing, that addresses the ripeness. To address the government's argument, the government is saying, well, you got to separate this out, this legal claim, basically they're saying it's severable. And so if it's severable, you know, I understand the point, but with respect to, it's not severable, and so there is no point.
So just so that I'm sure I'm understanding your argument, you're suggesting that the court first needs to consider the severability argument that you're making, and then we get to the justiciability question?
Right, that generally the court would consider the client's claim as part of the standing and ripeness analysis.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. On that point, I want to make sure I understand the claim here. So as I understand it, the claim is that because the Minnesota Constitution requires that every bill passed by the legislature must be presented to the governor for approval or veto, and the particular statute at issue here, which allows a majority of each house to end a peacetime emergency, because that statute doesn't specifically say, and you must present the vote to the governor for approval or veto, it's unconstitutional?
Well, yes, basically that's the general outline, but very specific.
Because my question is this, what about the statute that authorizes a majority of both houses to terminate the governor's peacetime emergency order leads you to conclude that if that were to occur, it would not need to be presented to the governor for in conformity with the constitutional requirement? I mean, understanding your argument to be that, well, this statute says they can ignore the Constitution. I'm not sure they get to ignore the Constitution. And I don't understand why, if both houses were to vote majority to end a peacetime emergency order, they wouldn't be required under the Constitution, as you've argued, to present that to the governor, and then we'd kind of take it from there.
So I'll reread the statute. By majority vote of each house of the legislature may terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. So in the part of the sentence that says the legislature may terminate a peacetime emergency, it says the legislature. It doesn't say.
Well, I understand that, but isn't everything the legislature does lawmaking? In other words, if the legislature terminates a peacetime emergency, aren't they doing that by passing a bill or a law? I mean, and wouldn't that fall within the constitutional requirements of Article 9, Section 22?
Yeah, I don't. The plain meaning of the text, as I read it, is the legislature is saying if they take a majority vote of each house of the legislature, they can terminate a peacetime emergency. So that's our argument, is that the statute is not consistent with Article 4, Section 24.
But do bills normally say... I mean, it's not the case that for every bill, there's a reference to the presentation clause, and then we kind of assume that, well, if there's no reference to the presentation clause, this is violating the presentation clause. I mean, I'm just, I'm having a hard time understanding why this wouldn't need to go to the governor. And I can imagine that perhaps appellants, if this were to happen and there were a majority vote in each house to terminate the peacetime emergency order, and somebody else said, well, this needs to go to the governor now, the argument might be, no, it doesn't. The language says it doesn't.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why the interpretation might be absurd is that that the governor, the legislature has already disagreed with the governor in the first instance.
Understood. So
then you would have to go back to the governor to get the governor's approval. So that would be one. There's no indication. In fact, beneath there in the third sentence, I think it is, nothing in this section limits the governor's authority over or command of the National Guard as described in the military code and so forth. So what it says is the legislature, if both votes, both houses vote by a majority to terminate, it's terminated. And that's what it says. And that's what we're left with. It's not uncommon to have to.
If I understand it correctly, that's not happened. So we're being asked to determine how all of this will work, hypothetically, if in fact at some point both houses vote by a majority to terminate an existing peacetime order.
Well, there's nothing hypothetical about the injury to my clients during this period that this act is being utilized by the governor.
Well, I agree with that. One can't dispute that, but that's a challenge to the restrictions of the act itself. I mean, the argument being these are improper restrictions, the governor's gone too far, he's done too much harm, those all go to the emergency order itself. Your clients haven't been harmed in the sense that there has been a majority vote in both houses to end the peacetime emergency and someone's refusing to do it. So there is harm, no doubt, but is the harm really connected to the provision you're challenging, or is the harm based on the actual prohibitions of the order itself or orders themselves?
Well, I guess it goes to a baseline issue. You know, Professor Sunstein talks about baselines. And so this provision deals with peacetime emergencies extending beyond 30 days. So the first 30 days, you know, I understand your point, but after 30 days, there's an obligation here of the governor to call the legislature in, and the legislature has to have a if it doesn't, the legislature fails in a majority vote, then the governor continues. So the question would be, what power does the governor have after 30 days? If the governor, everyone might assume and say, if the governor didn't call them into special session, then, that's not good.
We don't have that situation. I mean, I appreciate that. There's a parade of horrors here. You can come up with a lot of scenarios that would raise a lot of questions, but we have to decide this case based on the circumstances we have, which is the governor keeps extending these orders, but he keeps calling a special session to do it, and no one is voting to terminate the order at those special sessions.
Right,
people may agree and would like to, but it's not happened, so the issue hasn't really been teed up for us.
Yeah, it's very simple that our argument is the whole Emergency Management Act after 30 days is unconstitutional because this provision doesn't meet the requirements of the Constitution. And so I think that, you know, I get that it's, I mean, I understand, Eric's being kind of pushy because he's saying you got to look at the plaintiff's legal claim first, the petitioner's legal claim, and you got to take the claim at face value that the Emergency Management Act is unconstitutional because it has this unconstitutional provision that applies after 30 days. Okay, then you look at it and say, if it's not severable, he's got a point. If it's severable, but that's a different legal question than is being raised by the court here.
Counsel, can you cite the court to any case where this court or the Supreme Court has put the cart before the horse and addressed the issue of severability before determining whether a provision was unconstitutional or a statute was unconstitutional?
That's correct. That's what I meant to say. I may have miscommunicated. What I meant to say was with respect to the standing and ripeness issues, that we're claiming that we're being harmed by the government's power exercise under the Emergency Management Act, that's our claim. And so that standing and ripeness should be reviewed on that. With respect to the unconstitutionality of the provision, yeah, I have to win that first. My clients have to win that first before we consider severability. So with respect to the unconstitutionality, you know, if it really does turn on, you know, whether B incorporates the procedure of Article 4, Section 24, I just point to the language and the idea that the law requires the legislature, when terminating the governor's powers, to present that back to the governor for veto. It wouldn't be consistent with the language. It says the legislature.
Counsel, okay. When we're interpreting statutes, we're told first and foremost by the Supreme Court that whenever possible, statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and we need to read them in a way that would render them constitutional. So why wouldn't we read this statute as saying, well, that's all fine and good, but at the end of the day, the Constitution requires presentment of every law to the governor for approval or veto. So the way to read this statute in a constitutional way is to read it as saying the requirement you say is lacking is actually there. The Constitution does apply. There does need to be presentation to the governor, even though that's not expressly spelled out in the language, or even though one might argue it's not required.
May I respond? I see my time's out.
You may briefly, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Cargill.
Okay, thank you. The court, of course, is citing the rules of interpretation correctly. I think that this is sui generis. It's different. Everyone admits that. And then the point is that when we look at the statutory language, it seems that the legislative intent was exactly as I'm proposing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Liz Kramer. I'm our state solicitor general, and I'm here today representing Governor Tim Walz. A critical issue is that this court should not wade into the kind of important legal, political, and public health issues that Mr. Cardall would like it to, unless and until those issues have been properly put before it. That means by parties withstanding on claims that are ripe, and that those claims have been argued to and decided by a district court so that they're fully fleshed out and ready for this court to decide upon. Appellants simply haven't checked those boxes in this case. And for that reason, we ask this court to affirm the decision below and dismiss the petition for quo warranto. I'd like to touch on two issues this morning. The first is the appellant's failure to preserve their argument that the criminal penalties within the executive orders are some kind of violation of the separation of powers. And the second is appellant's failure to wait until their legislative veto claim is ripe before raising it with this court. Let me start with forfeiture, especially since that's an argument that Mr. Cardall didn't discuss with the court here this morning. The well-worn Thiel versus Stitch doctrine applies here to say that because the issue of criminal penalties was not presented before and decided upon by the district court, it is forfeited by appellants. Here, the petition for quo warranto said nothing about criminal penalties in the executive orders, and appellant's briefing didn't raise that issue before Judge Gilligan. Therefore, Judge Gilligan's order did not address the issue of criminal penalties in the executive orders. And even appellant's statement of the case didn't notify this court or the governor that they were changing their theory of the case. As a result, that argument, which was briefed by appellants in their primary brief, although not discussed again in reply or an oral argument this morning is forfeited. I'll note that the Minnesota Supreme Court confirmed that recently in the Morehouse decision in 2018, where it said that even though the appellant had been arguing due process issues all along in its case, that appellant had forfeited its right to raise a new procedural due process claim before the Minnesota Supreme Court, because that was a novel new theory that it had not allowed to be presented to the district court and decided upon. So under that same rationale, appellants have forfeited their argument about criminal penalties. Moving to the issue of the legislative veto, which is where you all have spent your time with Mr. Cardall, our position is that that issue is not ripe. Section 12.31, subdivision 2, talks about a majority of both houses deciding to end the peacetime emergency. The Minnesota legislature has had, I believe now, 10 opportunities to do exactly that and has not done it. And unless and until that happens, we don't know whether the state legislature will choose to present that legislation to the governor or to take some different course of action. So therefore, the issue is not ripe. In addition, the parties that really have skin in that game.
Council, before you move on to that, could I ask you, what is your position? If there were such a vote, is there an argument that it would have to be presented to the governor under the presentation clause?
Judge Larkin, there's definitely an argument that that should happen. But I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important that these issues have to be fully developed. Because if that would happen, you would expect, for example, that the legislature might come in to litigation over that issue, because the real parties in interest would be the legislature and the governor. And if that were to happen, maybe the legislature would say that one of those exceptions to the presentment clause applies here. But no one has had any incentive to do that in this case, because we haven't reached that point in time. But to your earlier point, Judge Larkin, I think the canon of constitutional avoidance is really important here. The section 12.31 subdivision B doesn't explicitly talk about presentment at all. And we shouldn't assume, as appellants do, that that means it forecloses presentment. Instead, under the constitutional avoidance doctrine, we should assume that it allows for presentment. Even on the merits, though, this legislative veto argument from appellants is lacking. There is no case in Minnesota law that strikes down a statute for being a so-called legislative veto, as Mr. Cardall calls it here. And even the cases that appellants cite from other jurisdictions are clearly distinguishable. You have that INS versus Chadha case from the US Supreme Court, which was really about a one house veto. That's fundamentally different than what we have here, where this is a bicameral vote that's being looked at in section 12.31.
But it's still not being presented to the governor, would be the argument from Mr. Cardall.
I understand that that's his argument, Judge Larkin. My point is that the INS versus Chadha case wasn't about presentment.
But the citing that case addresses indirectly the concern I have, which is the situation which would give rise to the need to stare down this issue, hear from anyone who is interested, get appropriate briefing, and make the decision. It's not been presented. So it's not necessarily been teed up all that well for this court to weigh in.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. And so I think you can affirm on ripeness grounds and not have to reach the merits of that legislative veto at all. To the extent, again, that this court were to look at some of the decisions from other states that appellant's counsel raises in one of their footnotes, I'll note that all those cases are from the 80s. They seem to be about a rash of state laws that took place where state legislatures wanted to micromanage the rulemaking of state agencies. That's not what we're talking about here. None of those cases have anything to do with emergency powers. They don't have to do with emergency powers being held by governors. They certainly don't have to deal with the unique circumstance of a pandemic that has killed now nearly 6,400 Minnesotans. So even if this court were to get to the merits, I would ask it to utilize the constitutional avoidance doctrine, but this is not a policymaking court, it's an error correcting court, and those decisions from other jurisdictions are not even persuasive.
Counsel, is there any other state statute that you're aware of that includes a similar provision that allows a majority vote of each house to basically overrule an action by the governor or terminate an action by the governor?
Judge Cochran, I'm not aware of a statute like that. So
perhaps that's why there isn't any case law directly on point.
That may be right. This statute has been in existence for quite some time, but no governor has had to use it to the extent that Governor Wallace has had to use it. So I think you're right that there just hasn't been an occasion to really challenge that aspect of this. But again, all the more reason to make sure that the issues are fully developed and that the real parties in interest have an opportunity to be heard first at the district court level before raising those issues with this court.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. I have a question for you about appellant's argument regarding the delegation being unlawful because, or the governor's order being unlawful because he prescribed a criminal penalty other than that authorized by the legislature. I understand that the state takes position that that argument is forfeited, but that's for this court to decide, not the state. So I would like you to address the merits of that argument. And specifically, as I read the state's brief, I understood it to mean, well, there has been an, let me pull up the statute so I can look at it. A penalty has been otherwise specifically prescribed by the governor. The question I have is, under the language of the statute, unless a different penalty or punishment is specifically prescribed, doesn't the phrase specifically prescribed beg the question, prescribed by whom? I mean, isn't that referring to the legislature who normally has the authority to define crime and punishment? You seem to read that as meaning the governor could set some other criminal penalty. Is that the state's position?
Thanks for the question, Judge Larkin. I would like to note that not only is our argument that they have forfeited this, but also that if this had been raised at the district court, I would have had different standing arguments to make because none of these appellants have ever been charged with criminal penalties here, nor do they assert in their petition for quo warranto that they would like to engage in any of the activities that are criminalized for business owners or businesses. But I understand that doesn't address the substance of your question. Section 12.45 explicitly authorizes the governor to impose criminal penalties for violations of executive orders. So that's our starting place. And it sets a default penalty for those executive orders at the simple misdemeanor level. But as you note, it has that important introductory clause that says, unless a different penalty is prescribed. And you're right, it doesn't say by whom, but we have to look at the context of that statute. The context is Chapter 12, which as we've said, is the Minnesota Emergency Management Act, which is generally talking about authority that the governor or whoever is in charge of emergency management can exercise. It's not talking about authority the legislature can exercise, because of course the legislature doesn't need an emergency to be able to exercise its power generally. So it makes most sense in context if this is referring to the governor. In addition, the legislature can always pass laws with criminal penalties. And so again, I think it would render that language superfluous if it were to be interpreted as referring only to the legislature there. So the governor's position is that unless a different penalty, that phrase, unless a different penalty is prescribed, refers to the governor and allows him to do what he's done here in very limited circumstances by increasing the criminal penalty from a simple misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor.
Is there anything that prevents the governor from increasing the penalty to a felony then, under your reading of the statute?
Your Honor, I think what prevents the governor from doing that is the guardrail of the legislature being brought back into the session every 30 days. So I don't think the plain language of section 12.45 prevents the governor from doing that, but I think political reality generally would prevent the governor from doing something unreasonable here in using his criminal authority under section 12.45. Unless there are further questions from the panel, I ask that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of the petition for quo warranto here. Thank you.
I have one additional question, if you know. Did I not read that the chair of the House or Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as the ranking minority member, have sponsored legislation to change this provision in the statute, which governs the criminal penalty that's associated with a violation of a governor's emergency order? In other words, is this issue something that's pending before the legislature right now with reportedly bipartisan support?
Your Honor, I am not sure about the specific criminal penalty aspect. I will say that throughout this peacetime emergency, so since last March, the legislature has engaged on a number of aspects of Chapter 12, and different legislators have proposed, you know, changes that they see appropriate. But again, none of those have passed yet. And the past legislature has passed this authority that we're looking at today, which does give the governor, like I said, authority to both put the simple misdemeanors in and enhance them if the governor sees fit.
That's your interpretation of the statute. The statute doesn't expressly say that.
Well, I think that opening phrase.
It's an argument. It's an argument, yes, that could be made, but it's undecided at this point.
Fair point. It says someone can specifically prescribe a higher penalty. With that, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I apologize. So I'll start with discussing the question and answer to Ms. Kramer regarding something like this. I know I'll get it wrong, but if there's such a vote under the statute, would it have to go to the governor? And then Ms. Kramer said that that's a possibility. That reflects page 33 of the government's brief. I'll read the sentence. Another possibility is the legislature would follow the typical constitutional process and present the resolution to the governor to provide him with the opportunity to either approve or veto the measure. So of course, I've litigated a lot of cases with the government. I've never seen such a tepid response with respect to what the purported legally offending text means. We're saying that the text means that when the houses vote by a majority, that the peacetime emergency has ended. And then we're hearing from the government, there's a possibility they'd have to follow Article 4, Section 24. So, you know, so I don't know if the government's not going to take a stance that subdivision 2B means that has to be presented to the governor after the legislature votes, then it's not even presented to the court. That would be waiver. I mean, there were a couple opportunities here in the briefs and in the oral argument here for the state to say subdivision 2B means that after the legislature takes a vote, it gets presented to the governor. And the sort of this interposition or of the idea that the state doesn't have to take a position because it's not ripe yet. I mean, this is a constitutional claim. I mean, yeah, it's presented. I mean, we're saying that this statute here, because it doesn't say that it has to be presented to the governor before the emergency powers are terminated, that this is a problem. And we're saying it's unconstitutional, and it's an unconstitutional part of the statute that can't be severed, and we're injured by that statute.
Counsel, in response to that argument, one could say, all right, the way to render it constitutional is to read the presentment requirement into the statute to say, no, it has to be presented to the governor. Is that what your clients want?
No, I'm saying what the state says here is another possibility is the legislature would follow the typical constitutional process. So they're not taking that position.
I'm going to make this simple as
counsel,
I can.
Sorry. Go ahead, Judge Larkin.
As simple as I can, you're saying the statute is unconstitutional because it doesn't require presentment to the governor, which is required by the Constitution. This court could remedy that alleged constitutional defect by holding that Section 4 or Article 4, Section 22 applies to this statute, and any vote to end a peacetime emergency must be presented to the governor. Is that what your clients want?
No, we do not want the court to amend statute.
I'm not talking about amending it. I'm talking about reading it consistent with the constitutional requirement that you claim applies and that you claim is lacking.
But Judge, with all due respect, it says the legislature may terminate peacetime emergency by majority vote. It doesn't mention presenting it to the governor. So the court has a tough spot here because the court can't amend the statute when it's reading it. And the legislative intent here was that the governor's powers would be ended by a majority vote of each house of the legislature. And so it's very important to us, my clients, that the separation of powers be protected in every way, including that the court not read statutes to be constitutional when a fair reading of the statute wouldn't incorporate, in this case, the presentment to the governor. So that's what we're arguing, is that I'm just presenting you a sentence, and I'm saying this is what the sentence means, and what that means is inconsistent with the constitutional provision, and I'm surprised that the government isn't making the argument the court has made. And so why—
Counsel, as I understood the state's argument, it's that the claim isn't right because we don't know how the legislature would act if it actually, there was actually a majority vote of each house, and that the legislature could, if there was a majority vote of each house of the legislature to terminate a peacetime emergency, the legislature could then present that to the governor. And the claim isn't right because that hasn't happened yet. There hasn't been a majority vote of each house of the legislature.
I understand.
So, and it seems to me that until there is a majority vote of each house of the legislature, the claim really isn't right.
So again, this gets back to so it says a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. So I think we'd all stipulate that we're beyond 30 days. So the question is, how does the governor extend the powers beyond 30 days. And we're saying this procedure is unconstitutional because of the reasons that I indicated. So the governor cannot constitutionally, under this statute, the Emergency Management Act, extend the emergencies beyond 30 days. There's no constitutional authority for it because there's no procedure provided in the Constitution that says by the majority vote of each house of the legislature may terminate anything the governor does. They need to be presented to the governor. Any action, any vote by the legislature per Article 4, Section 24. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Any further questions from the panel? All right. Thank you very much to counsel for both parties. Your arguments were very helpful today, and your briefing was helpful as well. We will carefully consider the issues in this case and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.